1 Timothy 5, we're looking at verses 1 to 16. And for my text this evening, I'd like to just read very briefly verse 3. 1 Timothy chapter 5, verse 3. Honor widows who are real widows. So what on earth am I going to make of that, you ask? Well, as many of you all know, for 3 years before I came here to All Souls, I had the privilege of working in an English-speaking church in the center of Paris. And one of the endlessly fascinating things about working there was that you never knew who you were going to meet next. One moment it might be a political refugee. Another moment it might be somebody wanting to join the Foreign Legion. Another time it was just some lost and lonely English soul looking for company. And you also never knew what they were going to ask. I recall on one occasion walking outside my office and finding a gentleman looking at the notice board. Being a kind, public-spirited person, I said, "Look, can I help you in any way?" He said, "Yes." He said, "I want a wife." Well, after I'd sort of thought of all possible replies to that and refused them, I eventually explained it wasn't exactly the sort of service that we offered. Perhaps he might like to look at the personal columns of the newspaper instead. But the most difficult request of all that we used to get was one of the endless ones for money and material help. Maybe it was a tourist who'd arrived at the Gare du Nord and had all their money and papers stolen and desperately wanted someone to help them out. Somebody else who claimed that they were destitute and needed money to get back to the UK. Somebody else had arrived in Paris without any money and just needed to get enough money on the train to get to a next door town where there was going to be a friend waiting for them. And there was simply no way that as a church we could accede to all their requests for money. We didn't have the resources. But how could we choose which ones we accepted and which ones we didn't? Again, we knew through experience that some of the people were lying. But which ones? We could never be sure. Now, I think we find the same sort of problem here in the centre of London in a church such as All Souls. Many of us have been asked for some form of help, maybe financial help by people. And the church here frequently is asked for that sort of help. As Christians, we know that we are called to show compassion to others. And yet there is a limit to the help that we can give. After all, we're not a sort of bottomless welfare agency here. So how do we know who we give to and who we don't? How do we handle situations like that? Now, one of the reasons I find the Bible so gripping is that it is so relevant and up to date. Though the situations may change, the principles of the Scriptures are of eternal significance. Now, at first glance, this passage in 1 Timothy 5 is all about how a church should deal with widows. And now, for some people, that may have a relevance, but I can't imagine that for many of us it's the most pressing problem of our Christian lives. And we'd be liable to skip over it. Look at the next passage instead. But if we were to do so, I think we would miss the extraordinary relevance of what Paul has to say here. Because at the very heart of 1 Timothy chapter 5, at least the first part of it, is not how a church should deal with widows, but that was the immediate situation Timothy faced. What it was really about was whether the church should be a social welfare agency. And if not, what should determine the help that we give to people and who we give it to? Now, that's a pretty relevant question, isn't it? It's especially relevant if you happen to work on the welcome desk. Now, before we look at that issue, which will occupy the most of the sermon, can I just say a quick word or two about verses 1 and 2 of chapter 5? Remember, Paul is writing to his younger brother, Timothy. And at this point, he gives advice as to how he is to deal with different people in the fellowship. Now, any young leader, maybe a curate, maybe a youth leader, maybe somebody who's recently become in charge of a fellowship group or a beginner's group or a student group or whatever, any young leader can find relationships a little bit difficult. After all, people begin to regard you slightly differently. They actually listen sometimes to what you say. They even believe it and pass it on to others sometimes. They are liable to put you on a bit of a pedestal. Or alternatively, they can resent the authority that you have. And it can be very difficult to work out how we should relate to other people in that sort of situation. That's true for those of us who are clergy, who are professional ministers, if you like. But it's true to an extent for all of us who are involved in leadership. And Paul, I think, gives very sound advice here. Treat the older men, verse 1, with respect. Don't rebuke an older man, but exhort him as you would a father. I imagine there were some older men in the congregation in Ephesus who needed a sharp word or two. And it was very difficult for a young pastor like Timothy to do it without appearing arrogant. And so Paul says to Timothy, treat the older men as you would your own father. I don't imagine it's very difficult to rebuke one's own father. I've never had to do it myself. He's had to rebuke me pretty often. But it is pretty difficult to rebuke somebody who is older and more mature than you. And so Paul says, treat that sort of person with respect, as you would your own father. Treat younger men as brothers, with naturalness. Again, it's very easy to treat the people for whom we are responsible as though almost they were our possessions. And Paul says, no, they are our brothers. And that is how you are to treat them. And our relationships with those over whom we exercise authority, particularly those of the same age as us, should be absolutely natural. They should be our friends, our brothers. Treat the older women with affection, like mothers. How often it's true, isn't it, that the older women in a church are the very heart and soul. They're the prayer warriors. They're the most faithful servants. So treat them with affection, like your own mother. Then the younger women, Paul says to Timothy, treat them like sisters. But he adds a very important proviso, in all purity. Do you see the extraordinary wisdom of the Apostle Paul? He knew how vulnerable Timothy was as a young leader in the church. He knew that Timothy was liable to be the focus of attention for many of the younger women there, some of it innocent, but not all of it. And so he says, be wise in your dealings. Do not give a wrong impression. Young men, I suppose one could address this to particularly. We know that we treat sisters differently than the way we treat other girls, other young women. And yet the innocent way in which we treat our own sister should be the mark of the way in which we treat younger women in the fellowship. If I can say this, I know to my cost and sometimes to my shame, that is not an easy balance to maintain. We can very easily fool ourselves. We can very easily think deep down that our behavior is innocent, when actually we know that it is not. And that is a word for all of us, isn't it? Maybe particularly for young men, and perhaps particularly for young male leaders. Be wise in dealings with members of the opposite sex. Don't lead on. Don't give a wrong impression. Treat the younger women like sisters in all purity. There's much more one could say on that, but we'll leave it there. Let's move on then to the main part of the passage, verses 3 to 16. This discourse about widows. And I believe the key to the passage lies in a little phrase that occurs three times. Verse 3, honor widows who are real widows. Verse 5, she who is a real widow. In verse 16 at the end, so that it may assist those who are real widows. The issue here, you see, is not whether the church should honor widows or not, but who are the widows the church should honor? Who are the real widows? It wasn't whether widows were worthy of attention, but which ones were worthy of attention. So let's look at it a bit more closely. First, let's see the problem. What is the problem that Paul is addressing? Now, I take it that Paul would never have written this much about widows in the church unless there was a particular problem in the fellowship at Ephesus. You see, caring for widows was axiomatic for anyone brought up on the Old Testament. In most societies at the time, widows had a very hard time of it. Having lost their husbands, they lost their status, they lost their privileges, they lost their position in society, they lost their financial security. And that is why the Old Testament lays such stress on the fact that God's people should make a particular provision for the widows. And there is a tremendous emphasis on it. God himself is seen as the protector of widows, Exodus 22. Judges and magistrates repeatedly are told that the widows should receive justice, Isaiah 1 verse 17 and many other places. farmers were asked to leave the corn that they'd missed out on their first harvesting so that widows could take it. They were to leave the second gleaning of the olives and grapes for the widows. Every third year, their tithe was to be given to the widows. They all knew that the widow should receive special care and attention. Now, here we have a New Testament church which consists of a number of people of Jewish background. They would therefore inevitably have recognized their obligation to look after the widows. They accepted it. That was not the problem. The problem was, which widows were they obligated towards? Which one should they look after? Now, evidently, in the church in Ephesus, there was a roll of widows, which we find referred to in verse 9. Let a widow be enrolled, verse 11, but refused to enroll younger widows. There seemed to be a roll. And if you signed on this roll as a widow, then you would receive money and support from the church. But in order to do so, you had to promise not to marry again. Well, what was the result? What had happened? Well, for a start, it seemed that every widow in Ephesus heard about it. They heard there were free handouts down at St. Ignatius, Ephesus, and so everybody flooded in. And the burden upon the church became intolerable. How could they meet all this human need? And then again, some signed up who were obviously unsuitable. They were very young, they would obviously want to marry again, and when they married again, they'd break their pledge. And that had often happened, apparently. It seemed also that a good number of the people on the list, on the roll, were non-Christian people. They may have attached themselves to the church, but it wasn't for spiritual reasons at all. It was because it meant that they would be given money. Now, we don't have to think very hard, do we, to see how relevant that is for us today. I hope we recognize that the church's primary task, the task that we have been given by Christ, is to take his gospel to the world. The work of evangelism, that is our primary calling. But yes, also we are called to show compassion to our world, to those in need. The trouble is that all too often our concern for physical needs and physical problems swamps and strangles our primary task. You see, we are surrounded by immense human need, and as Christians we can easily be overwhelmed by it. When people are desperate, the church is often the first place they will turn to, because the church will help me, the church will sort out my problems, maybe because they regard the church as a soft touch. And before we know it, we can easily be caught. Now we need to understand, that is what Paul was trying to say to Timothy, that the church of the Christian fellowship cannot bear the burden of indiscriminate welfare. We cannot solve all of society's physical problems, because if we tried to, it'd occupy all our time, our energy, and our resources, and there'd be nothing left for the work of the gospel. And we can perhaps see churches around us for whom exactly that has happened. They've become so caught up in that ministry that the ministry of the gospel has got squeezed out altogether. There is a very real problem today, as there was in the church at Ephesus. Let's look second then at the solution. How does Paul tell Timothy to deal with it? And I think these words are very hard words. They're not easy ones for us to hear. But what he basically says is this: you must use discrimination to determine those to whom you give help and those to whom you do not give help. You must give to the real widow, but not to the one who's not a real widow. So who are these real widows? The New International Version actually says the widows who are really in need, which perhaps gives a slightly different emphasis to it. But who are they? Three things. One, those who have no relations who can help them. Look at verse 4. If a widow has children or grandchildren, let them first learn their religious duty to their own family and make some return to their parents, for this is acceptable in the sight of God. And verse 8, if anyone does not provide for his relatives, especially for his own family, he has disowned the faith and is worse than an unbeliever. And again, we find the same idea coming up in verse 16 as well. You see, Paul makes it very clear that it is the human family that should take first responsibility for looking after those in need. We must not leave it to the church to deal with human need in our family if we can deal with it ourselves. Because if we leave it to somebody else, the church is brought into disrepute. We are seen to be worse than unbelievers. It's a very salutary reminder to us, isn't it, that we have responsibility to our own family. See, when we're young, our parents look after us. And therefore, it's only right that as we grow older, as our parents grow older, we repay some of that debt to them. Now, I know that relationships with parents, particularly perhaps very elderly parents, can be quite difficult. I know it's often something about which we feel guilty. But the principle remains. If we follow Christ, we must place a very high premium on looking after our own family. And if there are needs within the fellowship, it is the family, first of all, that should be meeting those needs, the human family. And it's only if there is nobody in the human family to look after them, then that we should step in as a church. And then second, the second condition is the person must be a committed believer. Again, it's a very difficult thing to grasp this, isn't it? Look at verse 5. She who is a real widow and is left all alone has set her hope on God and continues in supplications and prayers night and day, whereas she who is self-indulgent is dead even while she lives. Paul is drawing a distinction here, if you like, between the spiritual widow, the Christian, and the one who's unspiritual, the one who is outside the true fellowship. And verse 10, he goes on to say that the person must be a committed Christian. She must be well attested for her good deeds as one who's brought up children, shown hospitality, washed the feet of the saints, and so on. This person must reveal godliness and a servant spirit in their own life. We should give help to members of the Christian family who have proved it by the way that they live. They are our priority. It may seem hard, but isn't that actually what Jesus himself also taught? What, after all, was the new commandment he gave to us? That we were to love one another. And that was the way the world would know that we are his disciples. If we love one another, if we cared for those in the fellowship. Now, it's not to say that we don't help anybody outside, of course not, but it is to say that our first priority is for believers. And we don't have the same responsibility for those who are outsiders. And it may be that there are members in our own fellowship, in our own congregation, that we sometimes ignore. And we shouldn't ignore them. We should help them in any way that we can when they are in real need. So that is, if you like, the second condition. First, that there's no one in the family to help them. Second, that they're committed believers. And third, that they're over 60. Verse 9, let a widow be enrolled if she's not less than 60 years of age, having been the wife of one husband. I don't think there's anything particular about the age of 60. But what Paul is speaking against here is the idea of putting on this roll, this list, young widows. For two reasons. First, a purely pragmatic one. They would probably want to be married again. And if they were to do so, then they'll have to break their pledge in doing so. And there was nothing wrong in them being married again, as Paul said later on. There's nothing wrong in that. So don't put them on the list so they don't have to break their vow. That's a pragmatic reason. But then there's also a pastoral one. If these young women were to stay single, then too easily they would cause trouble. And I guess that is what was happening in the fellowship in Ephesus. Verse 13, besides that, they learned to be idlers, gadding about from house to house, not only idlers, but gossips and busybodies, saying what they should not. That seemed to have been going on within the fellowship. As has been said, Satan always finds work for idle hands and idle mouths to do. And so Paul says here, look, it's far better not to make these sort of promises which you can't keep, not to cause trouble, not to cause dissension in the fellowship as was happening. There's nothing wrong in getting married again, having children. I imagine that society wasn't difficult to find a husband, and Paul was saying it was much the wisest course to follow. That way, you see, the Church of Christ is not brought into disrepute. Now, in some ways, that's quite a hard teaching, isn't it? That's quite hard for us to accept. Doesn't that seem terribly difficult, almost judgmental? And yet, surely there is much sense in what Paul is saying. He is saying that church support should be based upon need and desert. Those who need help and those who deserve it. There must be an element of discrimination, otherwise we'd never be able to bear the burden of the need that we would face. That is Paul's solution to the situation in Ephesus. Let's look finally then at the application of it. What does it say to us as a church, as individuals? And I want to leave us this evening with four brief challenges. First, and we go back to the first two verses here, a challenge about our purity of life. It's a constant theme throughout the epistles, and particularly the pastoral epistles, that Christian leaders should set standards of purity, that we should give no cause for misunderstanding. We should allow no root of sin into our hearts. And too often, probably, we kid ourselves that our motives are not always as pure as we imagine them to be. So Paul says, be careful, be wise. You can't stop temptation, but you cannot stop it from taking root in your heart. Or was it Martin Luther once said, you can't stop the birds flying over your head, but you can stop them nesting in your hair. Purity of life. Then second, the priority of the gospel. Why was Paul so concerned about these goings on in Ephesus? Why do you speak at such length about this situation with the widows? Because it was interfering with the work of the gospel. It was getting Christ a bad name, where people were behaving in such a way that even unbelievers were scandalized. These people don't look after their own family. How appalling it is. But it wasn't just that. It was putting a drain on the resources of the church that it could not afford. And we need to see that the church's prime task, again, is the work of the gospel. And the best part of our time, the best part of our energies, the best part of our resources should go to the work of evangelism, building up believers, the work of the gospel. Because that is what matters. That matters for eternity far more than anything else does. And all too often, we have to admit that we're distracted, that our time, our money, our energies go elsewhere, when it's the gospel that is all important. Now, just to say that you probably know, we have a mission coming up here at All Souls next January. And this is a reminder to me and a reminder perhaps to all of us. The devil will look to throw in all sorts of distractions. We must not be distracted. It is the gospel that is of preeminent importance. So the purity of life, priority of the gospel. Third, provision for the needy. You see, to say that the church cannot bear the burden of indiscriminate welfare is not to say that we cannot support and we cannot give help to others. We must. And that is particularly true within the Christian fellowship. When we see brothers and sisters in genuine need, how can we ignore it? And that's particularly true of those who have no others to help them. Maybe the old, the ones who are single on their own. Maybe we know of people in our fellowship who are in need. What do we do to help? And if we can't help ourselves, surely we can notify somebody else who may be able to. We cannot bear the burden of every need in society, otherwise we drown. But we can bear the needs of our fellowship, and we should do that. Remember those devastating words that James wrote in his epistle, in his letter? Chapter 2, verse 15. If a brother or sister is ill-clad and in lack of daily food, and one of you says to them, go in peace, be warmed and filled, without giving them the things needed for the body, what does it profit? It's useless. And when we see brothers and sisters in need, we have an obligation to help. But then finally, there's the place of the family. We live in a society where families have sadly become much less important than previously. Maybe it's to do with our constant mobility that we're so often separated from them. But families, in a sense, have got something of a bad reputation recently. I don't know if any of you have heard that program on Radio 4 by John Cleese and his doctor, Families and How to Survive Them. I haven't listened to the series at all. But isn't that something of the prevalent attitude? Families are something to survive. Yeah, that's not God's attitude. God has given us families for our own good, for our support. They're to be enjoyed. They're to be thanked. They're to cause us to thank God for them. And we have obligations to our families as well. And if we don't look after them, if we don't care for our own families, we are not worthy of the name of Christ. And perhaps that's particularly important, again, for younger members of the congregation. Most of our lives, we've looked to our parents as being the people that we lean on and depend upon. There comes a time when the situation changes and the roles are, as it were, reversed, when they begin to lean on us and depend upon us. And that's not something to be shirked or dreaded or avoided. It is a great privilege, but it is also a responsibility. Yes, it can be difficult, but it is our responsibility. And if we have no concern to look after them, then Paul says we are worse than the unbelievers. And that's quite a challenge.